reading from the Sri Vihagavatamrita, Part 1, Chapter 2, Text 7. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sahasranayane Asru Dharavasantanasane Sriye Nishanam Patparshve Ajantam Svabhibhutidhi. Indra shone forth in his own opulence as he sat on his own throne next to the Lord, shedding from his thousand eyes a downpour of tears. Commentary. It was natural for Indra, the ruling king of heaven, to have his own throne in his assembly hall. Yet while his servants stood by holding his royal paraphernalia, his umbrella, chamara fans, and so on, Indra worshipped the Supreme Lord in person, in the person of his younger brother. Indra loudly chanted the Lord's glories, describing the kindness of his devotees and other attractive qualities. Indra then recalled the special favors repeatedly shown him by the Lord, such as the Lord regaining for him the rulership of heaven, which had been seized by Bali Daityaraj. Omi Jnanasimarandasya Jnananjanasarataya Chaksurangotamyena Kajmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovishtam Statitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kanmai? Okay. I'll see you what. Okay. The Bhaktisha Padantikam Adadanastanam Dante Idam Nache Kunapuna Sinadrupa Padam Bhoja Ulisham Janma Janmari Taragi Bhakti Vasam Priyatnai Ayamam Marabit Sumantam Kutam Buriya Paradruga Dugi Vansha Kalpa Purupyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhayevacha Putitanam Padanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasadi Ghosh Naptavinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Greetings from Udupi, which is the seat of Madhva Acharya, where his main Udupi Krishna deity is here with their main Acharya. I explained before that they have a very interesting system of worship. There's, I think, 8 different village areas where Madhva Acharya perhaps prominently preached. And each of those areas has one mutt from Madhva Acharya. There are 8 mutts. And there's a senior Acharya and a junior Acharya. And the senior, the way it goes is that when the senior Acharya dies, the junior Acharya becomes the senior Acharya. And then they search for a new junior Acharya. And they go in that district to Brahmin families, and they take the astrological charts, and they search for someone who is gets karmically qualified for renunciation. There's no one else that takes sannyas. And then the junior sannyas is usually anywhere between 8 and 12. He takes sannyas, and your danda is your size when you take sannyas. Even when Iskan, you take sannyas, the danda should be the sannyasi size. And they have that system of perpetuating their line. I mean, one very prominent, I think it's Vishwa Tirtha, Pajava, from the Pajava Math. I met him 30 years ago in Bangor, where he had like a school. He also came to one, Prabhupada's centennial. And, you know, they're very strict. They have to bathe in a holy river. You know, it's a very sectic and disciplined lifestyle, how their sannyasis live, actually. When he came, he didn't stay in any of the guest houses. He stayed in a kutir in Bhakti Vidyapurna Swami's Gurukul, and he bathed in the Ganga in the morning. There's certain sectic rules. Interesting. And that person has been an acharya since he's 12 years old. That's like almost 63 years. He's 75 now or something like that. And then every 8 years, one of their acharyas takes over their main temple, and what he's collected in those previous 14 years, and that 2 years he spends for, I guess, propagating their mission and doing different activities. So it is a holy place, and we are the Brahma Gaudiya Madhva Sampradaya. Actually, a couple of people wrote me that they do like at the beginning of the class, I do give a little travelogue, perhaps where I am, although I'm not a extensively traveling sannyasi at all. But before I begin, you know, every time I'm in a new place, there's new cell phone reception. Can someone just confirm that the reception's okay?
It's fine, Maharaj. You sound good.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. So let me give just a little travel. I was at Bhakti Golovanda Singha Maharaj's, one of his ashrams, and I told you how scenic it was. It's on a peninsula, and it faces this very fresh, clear river. You know, the water is coming out of the mountains, and that's where it goes into the sea. So 300 yards across from the ashram, across from the river, is perhaps, part of the inland, part of the coast of India. So and then it kind of somehow turns out into the ocean, and very, very septic. And I have a very long-standing relationship with Nrisimha Maharaj from Vrindavan in 1976. And our relationship was always interesting because I can't say he was always adventurous, and my mood was always to just stay in my room. And he was always trying to intrigue me with adventure. In fact, he's from Texas, and he's very tall. And when he used to hold his danda over his shoulders, kind of like, you know, straight out, it looked like a musket. And myself and other friends of mine there, we used to call him Davy Crockett. So even here when I'm in the ashram, he's a very good sannyasi. There's only, I believe, five or six sannyasis, maybe, you know, there's definitely less than a dozen, but I would say probably half a dozen sannyasis that have taken sannyas from Prabhupada. Even Giriraj Swami or Jagvaita Maharaj didn't take directly from Prabhupada, even Indrajumna Swami. So I think there's Jagatapaka Swami, Trivikram Swami, Lokanath Swami, maybe Tripurari Swami, Bhakumar. So it's just a few. And of course, there's some of our dear godbrothers have passed away, like Shri Krishna Samaj, Srila Sridhar Maharaj, Srila Gaurabinda Swami. These were all also Tathagatas from Prabhupada. Bhakti Chuswami also took from Prabhupada. There's only a few. So he's very good. I mean, he's very excellent standard. But, you know, his exercise is the water. He found himself getting very ill, you know, and then he decided, hey, heck with this. And he took up this. He used to live in Hawaii, you know, so he likes the water, and his brahmacharis also, they all have their surfboards. They're very strict, obedient, etc. It's not chopati in a way, that type of, but who they are, they're very good brahmacharis, nice devotees. And, you know, they're young. They were, most of them joined when they were 10, 11, and they're, you know, right now 20 or whatever it is. So they're good. He's kept them very alive, and he shows them adventure. So he said, when I'm there, he's always trying to entice me. So finally, on the last day, to please him, I went on his speedboat. Which is not really what I wanted to do. It's just not my thing. I was in my room at one of his studies. He took me out in a speedboat, and I sort of put on my life preserver, and there's a dock, and, you know, we went down the river just for about another 50 yards, and then you turn where it kind of cuts through the coast of India, this river, and then you go out, and you went all the way out in the ocean, and, you know, bathed in the ocean, and, I kind of had my Virat Rupa realization, how healthy it is to realize God through nature. Because it really, you know, it's not my thing. You know, the ocean is so deep, so vast. You know, swimming in the ocean and just like, you're humbled. You know, you're humbled by nature. And, I mean, that was the Virat, in the Bhagavatam, the first step of God realization was the Virat Rupa. That's the associating God's manifestation with God, and it is God's energy. And if you see it connected to God, you'll understand how great God is, and you'll become humble, and that's the first step in God realization. Well, it was humbling going out into the ocean, and beautiful. You know, I kind of appreciated the people that, you know, look at the sunsets and appreciate how healthy it is. And therefore, you know, in the Bhagavatam, when Prabhupada described Dwarka and how beautiful it is with its gardens, Prabhupada described that the rulers of the world, you know, they all have their country estates. And, you know, he called, you know, the modern cities, you know, and the squalor that people live in, you know, dungeons of demons. So I kind of had an appreciation, you know, it was nice, actually. We went out for a short walk, and very healthy, just the air. The ocean is very good for the lungs. The rivers are very good for the nerves. You can actually feel it. And it was nice. So we went out. It was nice. And now I'm in Udupi, and a former student of mine, when he was 9 years old, from Radharaman Goswami family, father is a friend of mine, a great saint. He's my age. His son, a very successful Ayurvedic clinic in the room next to me. It's like I had a very beautiful, he gave me a very beautiful, nice apartment with marble floors, and there's two bedrooms and a living room, dining room, very big. Next to me, there's some devotees from Chopati that are recovering their health. Gauri John was here to Jagat Tarini during Kartik. I'm here on his offer, and I'm going to get the above 50 rejuvenation process to keep your body strong. Okay, now we can go into the one other thing. I'd like to share you something that I've read, and it's about faith, and it's this book I'm reading by this Gaudiya Grihastha scholar. He was an engineer, and he retired to Vrindavan, and he wrote some books on the holy name, and they were translated into English, and I find them very edifying. And, you know, he was talking about faith, and I just wanted to read his definition and share it. A person who has faith is qualified for bhakti. By the word faith, one means trust, a firm certainty that if one performs bhakti to Krishna, all actions are thereby accomplished. With the appearance of this state of mind, one's being a Vaishnava begins. So Vaishnavism begins with this state of mind of faith, and it's a trust in performing bhakti. That there's shelter there, that there's complete shelter there. And to the extent that you develop this state of mind is the extent that you can enter deeper and deeper into bhakti. And therefore I was just reflecting on the non-bhaktis that I do in Kartik and how healthy it is for my spiritual life. I think we see in Chopati and other places that they do these pilgrimages. I mean, even our little Kanihati festival, whatever it is. Really the purpose is to, spend some time fixed in Krishna consciousness so you can get that sense and experience, of faith in the name and faith in the process. Because that disposition of mind will allow you to enter into the holy name. I'm seeing that I'm still kind of the potency of Kartik and doing that reciprocation, appreciation from spending time with the name. In that regard, Satchinandana Swami is doing a holy name retreat, I believe, in a very high upper end retreat center. I mean, it probably cost about $300 or $400 for the weekend, but you get what you pay for, and it's by this famous Buddhist scholar. I think the person who runs the retreat or owns it or is connected with it is Robert Thurman. He's a famous Western professor of Buddhism at Columbia University. So it's like these retreats. But I think the sense I'm saying is how important our lives. And those of you who are close to me, we can discuss something like this, that perhaps organizing some form of retreat sometime so that we can develop this disposition of mind, which comes with intense contact with spiritual activities and the association of societies. It's invaluable. It's nice to have functions that serve a social purpose in Krishna consciousness, and I think that's also generates faith. But these retreats, these yatras, these pilgrimages, how important they are. I like it. Disposition of mind, certainty. And, unfortunately, that's how, to the degree that we have that faith is the degree, not unfortunately, but fortunately, the degree we have that faith is the degree that we endeavor in Krishna consciousness. So it's very, very humbling, because I can see my own lack of faith and my faith in so many other things that I kind of feel really give me shelter. Of course, there's so many necessities we have to do, but I'm thinking of my own activities in the world and things that are perhaps not in Krishna consciousness that it goes beyond what I just need, but a certain faith that this will actually be sheltered. Now the verse, we're up to Indra, and we're getting this vision, because of course, previously there's the king, and he was in the midst of so much opulence, dedicated everything to Krishna. And we saw him. And not only did he dedicate everything to Krishna, but he was so concerned to provide shelter for others for their Krishna consciousness. What a great leader. What a great leader. When we went into Prabhupada's room in 1975, about Gurukula, the Dayananda was there and some other people. Dayananda was the headmaster. And Prabhupada looked at us and said, so you call yourself teachers. What is the purpose of education? And someone said four things. Mangana Baba Madhvatko Madhyuji Namaskar. Prabhupada said, oh yes, yes. Prabhupada wanted something else. Then Dayananda said nine things, and he quoted Shravanam Kirtan Vishnu Smaina. Then Prabhupada quoted this verse, Guruna Sasyat Sajanina Sasyat Pitana Sasyat. Don't become father, you know, guardian, leader, guru, the teacher, unless you can save one from birth and death. And then you're in a position of responsibility. Your duty is shelter. And shelter means provide someone's needs for the highest purpose of Krishna consciousness. We all are responsible for someone or something. And so the king provided shelter for everyone in the kingdom. That was his goal. His goal as a leader is to provide shelter, not to be worshipped or glorified, not to control or enjoy. It was to provide shelter. And a leader who provides shelter and is in the mood of providing shelter, everyone follows. And this was the nature of this king. And we can go on and on and on, but and he was prosperous and everyone was obedient, so God, and he was humble. Because he himself was a devotee, his purpose was not to be worshipped or controlled, it was to serve. So as a king, he was serving others. And therefore, when he had opportunity, he himself was washing the floor. Devotees used to, in the temple, everyone had stories of Jayananda Prabhu, who Prabhupada glorified as such a wonderful devotee, of the person, you know, just a humble soul. Even when he was in charge, he was taking out the garbage, he was doing different things, and his mood was always so much service in that way. It was very, and the first time I saw him, when I first met the devotees, I was traveling around California, and the only place we could stay is in a parking lot of a football stadium with my friends in a car and use someone's apartment to go to the bathroom. And the back of that, you know, onto that parking lot was on Frederick Street. So the stores on Frederick Street, the back of the stores faced the parking lot. So I wake up in the morning, we saw this tall person fixing the car. It was Jayananda. And then he was sending some devotees off someplace. And we thought he was patting their back. And he was giving shelter. He was the shelter. But, you know, his identification was not that I am the Lord and controller, but I am the shelter-giving servant of Krishna and servant of the devotees. So nice. So this king, and then of course, because he's humble, and he humble and satisfied in heart by taking shelter of Krishna and feeling that love in his heart, he's happy in the position of servant. So when he is glorified, you are the greatest. It's just like Prabhupada, and so is it Prabhupada, and then there's a story where I think it's Trivikram Swami, Prabhupada just defeated these Maya bodies, and in the evening he was massaging Prabhupada's shoulders, and anyway, he was massaging Prabhupada's shoulders and very affectionately, you know, in the evening, and then, you know, due to his previous samskara, his impressions, he was just envisioning that it was like Prabhupada was like the heavyweight champion of the world, and sitting on a stool, and he just knocks someone out, and he's kind of, you know, the trainer or something. And he couldn't control himself. He said, "Sure, Prabhupada, you are the greatest." And Prabhupada said, "No, I'm just a servant." And that's Vaishnava, because he's not on the bodily platform. And he doesn't experience. The body is meant to experience what? Criticism, praise, honor, dishonor. This is what the body is about. The body is the fruit of activities. It's a creation of fruit of activities. It's a creation of envy and the desire to enjoy. So when you're a great devotee, you're identifying with the soul. So you're beyond this. So he points to this Indra. And that's what's happening now. And he glorifies Indra. How he's such a powerful person and he has this Parijata flower. One scent of that Parijata flower fulfills all desires for good music, good singing, whatever you want. Just the smell of one flower makes you practically immortal. So he's glorifying this position of Indra. And then Narada goes, and when he actually sees Indra, he sees that generally when someone describes something, what actually happened is not as great as he describes it. Usually we tend to tell stories and make it embellish it. But he saw that actually, although the king was so enthusiastic about Indra and Indra's position as a devotee, saying, oh, king said, I'm not a devotee, Indra's a devotee. Still, when he saw Indra, it was even more wonderful. Because one thing he said, that in Indra's greatest fortune, he's blessed that Brahmana, the Supreme Lord, is his brother. So he actually, when he sees that, he sees Lord Vishnu with the demigods and the exchange of affection between them, and then he sees how that affection he sees Lord Vishnu with the demigods, which includes Indra, and he sees how that affection for Vishnu, that bhakti for the Supreme Lord, is manifest in such elaborate and wonderful ways, and there's this puja going on where in the proper order all 64 items of worship is there. And he sees the demigods singing and dancing and praying, and the demigods, the siddhas, the prayers, when you hear beautiful Sanskrit prayers, it has so much potency. So these Sanskrit prayers were being chanted in such, you know, meter and potency and glorification. And when you hear good music, but the Vidyadharas, they're the greatest musicians in the world. We cannot even imagine the musicians of the demigods, and their music is with such soul. And the Vidyadharas are the best singing, and they're singing to the music of the Vidyadharas. What a scene, and the devotion and the prayers in the background, and then the heavenly Apsaras begin to dance, and they're the supreme dancers. And there the Supreme Lord is looking with a gesture of fearlessness to Indra, don't worry, I will protect you. And here we have Indra himself shining forth in his own opulence. He sits on the throne and he's shedding from his thousand eyes a downpour of tears. So now we're seeing also the two things about the demigod. It's described the higher material situation, the more rarefied existence that is free from distress, like described, no thirst, no hunger, practically immortality, and omnipotent. So it describes this higher rarefied existence that allows one direct association with the Supreme Lord. And what describes that, and it describes his superior position, because after all, this whole book is what? It's Narada's search, right? At least the first part. It's Narada's search for the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy. So his great power and opulence is actually also described. It will happen later in this chapter, which is nice that Indra's going to make it clear. Because he's also, in one sense, he's a devotee, and in his better moments, when he doesn't get carried away by Tribhuvana Aishwarya, the opulence of the three worlds, What a temptation. Had to be a devotee, to be the humble servant, to be detached and to see everything for God and be the king of heaven. The degree of opulence is unparalleled. The degree of power is unparalleled. It's practically the fulfillment of the fruitive desire when someone comes to the material world to be in that type of allurement. But here, he's shedding tears in association with the world. But he'll make it clear later on in this chapter. He discounts this power of the Lord that he got actually being mercy. That's not the real mercy. Of course, he'll even discount the association with Narayani for that. He's only a part of a part of the Supreme Lord, and he embarrassed me because this is Ramana, and he embarrassed me. He got back my kingdom from Bali, but he did it in a deceptive and cheating way, and then, furthermore than that, then all of a sudden, you know, he came and he came back, because he's also manifest as Christian, and he stole the Pari, got the flower and the Siddham assembly out, and he took it to the earth planet where they're near mortals. So, and you're telling me, because it's going to come up that Lord is going to praise on the strength of good fortune, you live in the realm of heaven, and you act and you act and travel as you like, and then because it's still actually a material position in your encounter, don't you know how many times you have to flee in fear of the demons? and in fact, one time when Bali took over, I was starving. Anyway, whatever it is, the demigods are fixed in goodness. He describes their quarrelsome, their sinless. He describes how he killed Dhritarashtra. So according to Indra, the demigods are undeserving because they are hardly better than ordinary men because they're still the material god form. So that type of praise as mercy is basically even discounted as Indra by Indra himself. But still, described. So Lord Vishnu then proceeded to his own residence. Indra followed him to some distance and then returned to the assembly hall where Narada greeted him and began to speak. So just see the culture also that Narada did not glorify Indra in front of Brahmana. Although it's his younger brother, Brahmana is the Supreme Lord. And this is, it's so nice, the subtleties of the culture. But one is very, very, because one of the main things in a proper culture is to make yourself a receptacle of mercy. Especially in the form of the Supreme Lord and sadhus. So, just see that he's very, very hesitant to glorify Indra in front of Dhammadev. I was thinking of one story in that regard, if I can, is when Uddhava on the order of the Supreme Lord is on his way to Badranath. And he's on that way from Dwarka, where he actually saw Krishna leave this world. And Uddhava, very interesting story, that Uddhava was there with Maitreya Muni. Now Maitreya Muni was elder and more respected and considered more learned. Maitreya was the greatest Gyani Bhakti. He had so much knowledge. When the Supreme Lord was leaving the world, he was intimate and reciprocating with Uddhava, who is a more intimate devotee. Uddhava is the most intimate devotee of the Supreme Lord outside of Vrindavan. Because he's his parishad. It's almost like you have a secretary who becomes practically your brother. That's what a parishad is. And Krishna would practically never go anywhere without Uddhava. And when Krishna had to deliver a message to the gopis, he had to find his most confidential devotee to do it. If there wasn't some degree of intimacy, they could not carry that message, they could not have any realization of that message, and they would be too confused to deliver it. So outside of Vrindavan, Uddhava, he's Bodhisattva, he has the topmost intelligence. And he's so much in the bhav and mood of Krishna that he has Krishna's color. Vana, or the caste in India, traditionally also Vana means color. Vana also means category. So the Brahmins were very light skin. And Krishna was dark. And Uddhava was from a higher caste, but Uddhava had the same color of Krishna, because when you're close to someone, you take their mood. And we discussed even with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the mood manifests externally. The mood manifests externally. When I describe, yes, sure, when you're red with rage, green with envy, pale with fright, there's some correlation. So the follower, he takes the mood. So Uddhava was so close. So he sent him to Vrindavan, and of course he delivered the essence of Krishna consciousness to the gopis. He told the gopis who were in separation. He delivered the message from Krishna to the gopis. And what was Krishna's message to the gopis? That I am there in my bhava manifestation. And that's a fact. No one is separated from God by a physical distance. You are separated by consciousness. And when you have that Krishna consciousness, Sri Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavatami, when you have that Krishna consciousness, you are with Krishna. So one is an actual deep separation from Krishna, and therefore develops love for Krishna. He's with Krishna. But anyway, when he goes, this is the point, when he goes, he sees Vidura. And when he begins to talk about Vidura, he tells Vidura that Krishna on his, we couldn't call it deathbed, but when he's about to leave the planet, from his heart, he's asking, how is Vidura? How is Vidura? And Vidura was just shocked, because in a loving relationship, if you love someone, you want to be in their heart. And because he's a devotee, he's very humble. And then he asked Uddhava, tell me about Krishna. And Uddhava began to explain, in summary, all of Krishna's pastime. And at a particular time, he stops and he says, I cannot instruct you any further, because nearby is Maitreya Muni, and he is senior to me. So just see the nature of the Vaishnavas. So Narada, in the same way, in front of the church, he went, now that Indra has walked the Supreme Lord back to his quarters, Narada greets him and he begins to speak. And he says, you have received the Supreme Lord's mercy, because demigods like Surya, Chandra, and other rulers all obey your orders. Sages like me are your subjects. The Vedas praise you as the Lord of the universe. You bestow the fruits of religion and irreligion. How wonderful that Lord Narayan has become your younger brother, born of the same womb, honoring the ways to civilize life. He always treats you with respect. I'm going to finish now with one point that a question I believe that Mahamuni asked, and I gave a description of when Sadhu told me, Nehitik, if your stomach is not good, then your head is not good for spiritual life. If you have disease, it's hard to think of Krishna. And therefore, it almost appears that a karmic situation is favorable to spiritual life. It's not. Actually, good health is considered a sign of piety because it's helpful spiritually. So I was thinking of that situation. What's the, is a devotee who's free from all anxieties and all difficulties, is he better off in Krishna consciousness? So I was just thinking like this, that there's always two things. There's always karma, your destiny, and your free will, how you react. So with our free will, naturally we always try to, somehow we try to put ourselves in a more favorable position for Krishna consciousness, naturally. As a devotee, we're trying to take care of our health, naturally, because we know that it can facilitate our Krishna consciousness. But somehow or other, despite that effort, if they're not actually getting better, or if our situation is not changed, then we also understand that destiny, our free will and our destiny are both meant to bring us closer to Krishna. And therefore, when we have a situation which is beyond our control, we can understand that that's favorable for our Krishna path. Just like I remember one time in India, a long time ago, I got malaria. And I was sitting there, and the fevers were coming, and I was thinking, well, what is Krishna doing? I can't chant. How is this better for my Krishna consciousness? Wouldn't it be better for my Krishna consciousness if I was healthy and focused, etc.? But then, thinking back on it, that the experience of difficulty invoked in me a certain detachment, which was a component of my consciousness that I required for Krishna consciousness. So the destiny, yes, it's meant for our Krishna consciousness, but it doesn't mean that we don't have free will to try to react to our destiny for Krishna consciousness. Anyway, something like that. I'm going to stop now. Are there any questions?
Maharaj?
Yeah, Mohini.
It's Mohini again. If no one else had a question, there was something that came up.
Please ask. It's been
okay.
Helpful.
Okay. Well, this started, this question started in the other class, the Sunday class, when we were talking about the Purdan. But I think it relates to this discussion too. And it's something like my previous question, but a little different. So, Maharaj, we understand that Krishna is absolute. And
that Krishna is what?
Absolute.
Yeah, okay.
And usually when we contrast the absolute with the relative, we understand what relative things are, in that they change according to the circumstances in which they're experienced. So the color blue in this world is relative, because if you have some kind of damage or something, you might see it in a different way, just some kind of eye damage. Or something is sweet in this world to some people but sour to other people, so it's relative. So my question is, it seems that Krishna himself is experienced differently according to the different types of people who relate to him. So how do we understand Krishna as being absolute, when in fact the experience of Krishna changes according to factors that seem to be outside of Krishna? I'm going to mute my phone now, if that's okay.
What then?
I'm going to mute my phone now.
We may have to discuss it, because it's a little bit hard to hear. But
okay.
But I'm going to explain this. This is the philosophy that Chintya Veda Veda Tattva. Right? Krishna is absolute, which means that Krishna's absolute means that everything, nothing exists without Krishna. So there's this verse which I always quote, Vedanta Tattva Vigas Tattva Yajnanam Advayam, that what is the Tattva or the absolute truth? It's Advayam Jnana, it's consciousness which is non-dual. It means everything is within that consciousness of God, everything is composed of that consciousness of God, and there's nothing outside of that consciousness of God. But what Jiva Goswami explains, what this means is that Krishna is not different from himself. Angana yasya sapalendriya vrittimanti, it means, you know, he can impregnate with his eyes, he can eat with his hearing, all his limbs can perform the functions of all his other limbs. So he's non-different from himself. He's non-different also from he's not different from those things which are the same as him, like Vishnu expansions. They're also his energy. And he's non-different from things that are in a different class. For example, different classes, a table and a chair, they're in a different class, right? So Krishna is not different from himself. He's not different from things in the same class as him. Like a chair and a chair in the same class. So Krishna and Vishnu are in the same class. And he's non-different from things that are in a different class, which means the material world. And how is he non-different from the material world? He's non-different from the material world because it doesn't exist without him. So this is Achintya Veda Veda Tattva, that he's simultaneously one and different with things. This is the whole philosophy of Krishna consciousness, that he has energies, and those energies, which are non-different than him, can function in different ways. And manifest in a different class even, like the material world. So therefore, everyone can experience Krishna in a different way. And the fact that Krishna is a person means that that absolute reality can manifest himself in different ways according to as one surrenders, then he responds accordingly. Everyone is in my path in all respects. So it's just that the example would be as a particular person. Someone relates to him as the boss, and that person manifests himself absolutely in a particular way. And someone's a friend, that same person manifests himself in a different way. Someone is a mother, that same person manifests himself in a different way. And even ourselves is one entity that people are experiencing. You meet someone on the street, he is associating with you, but his perspective of you is dependent on how much you reveal to that person. And you reveal to that person according to your relationship with them. So it was a little hard to hear your question because, well, you know, the connection was okay.
Well, Marsh, in our normal way of speaking, we would say that the guy in the street only has a relative perspective of me because he doesn't know all of me. In our normal way of speaking, so it seems to me what... Sorry?
Good.
So it seems to me what we're not using the word absolute maybe the way it's always used. We might be using it in a little bit of a different way. It seems to me that your way of explaining it is that absolute means that Krishna is present everywhere and everything depends on him. And in that sense, he's not relative because it's not like Krishna's influence only exists here but not there. But it doesn't mean that everything experiences Krishna in the same way. Right. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's...
No, I think I just want to say, so what you're saying is But because we can experience Krishna in a different way, right, and the experience of Krishna is relative to our approach, it doesn't mean that Krishna is relative.
I'm just trying to understand this, because there are people like, you know, I'm reading, you know, I'm reading some, you know, medieval Catholic theologians and also other people who say, you know, when you experience God, you experience the same thing every time. That's because it's God and God's absolute. It sounds kind of like Mayavadis, actually, where, one of the good arguments for Mayavada philosophy is in different cultures, people have this experience of Brahman, and they have a similar description of it, and that indicates this absolute. And we say, well, people have all sorts of experiences of Krishna, and they're all different. And so I'm just trying to understand what it means that Krishna is absolute, although you can have almost limitless types of experiences of Krishna.
It's dependent on your perspective. I mean, that's the whole verse. When it explains what is the absolute, those who know that absolute, what do they say? They say, it's non-dual consciousness. And it is called in different ways according to your approach. So I would say that it is impersonal. If those particular theologians say that everyone has to experience God in the same exact way, it limits his personality. It's actually limiting him, because we say that God is Kila, Rasamrita, Murti. He's the full embodiment of different flavors of love. And that the whole, isn't that beautiful when Krishna walks into the wrestling arena, and that verse is there from the Bhagavatam, which describes that every person, the wrestlers see in the sphere personified, you know, the citizens as a great hero, his parents as his loving child. So it seems that this is the unique contribution of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his Achintya Beda Beda Bhatra, is simultaneously one of the Akila Rasamrita Murti, is the embodiment of full relationships. And then the question is whether that differentiation or that variegatedness makes him less or more. And in Vaishnava philosophy, I guess we say that if you limit him in his expressions of himself, then that's a more relative conception. I remember I was joking about it. I did get a BA in philosophy in college, but I didn't, you know, late 60s, early 70s, we weren't very serious students. It's kind of great at that time, though. I mean, one year we closed down the whole last 2 months of school protesting the war, you know. I mean, it was quite a irresponsible time. It shouldn't be debated, but anyway. But I remember I was studying philosophy and the definition of God, that being of which no greater can be conceived. And when I got the first Krishna book, and I saw Prabhupada's explanation of God and description of Krishna as that absolute person of which nothing is outside of, having this personal life, I thought that that was a much greater conception than the impersonal conception or the conception of God as the creator. Mahamuni.
Yeah.
One more comment, please.
Well, I think, if I understand what you're saying, Maharaj, is that to say that we experience Krishna in different ways, that doesn't impose a limitation on Krishna. Krishna is still absolute. But the point is, you know, that our experience of him differs according to, in some ways, us and the relationship. But that doesn't mean, that's not in some way limiting Krishna. It's just implying that there's different ways to experience Krishna. Anyway, that's how I understood you. I mean,
it seems. I wonder what those philosophers were thinking. I guess it is a kind of Brahman realization, which is also God.
Yeah.
But, go ahead.
My Guru Maharaj has said that Mayavadis have a relative conception of God in the sense that they try to understand God by taking away their experience of relativity. So their entire experience of God is still rooted in their material experience. So in some way, their conception of God is still limited. But if you allow the internal potency and you understand it, and the idea of transcendental variegatedness, that's allowing God to exist on his own without throwing our conceptions over him. So, anyway. But thank you, Maharaj, for helping me understand that.
No, that was good. Okay. I guess I'm going to get settled in here now. And I think we'll continue up the ladder of great personalities. I'm trying not to discuss every verse, but we'll go on now next to Lord Brahma. And then it's going to really get fun when we get into Hanuman, Prahlad. And Prahlad points to Hanuman, and that's really nice because Prahlad, he has an appreciation of God. And when he's glorified by Narada, we'll get into this. He looks at Narada and says, I'm not the great devotee, he said. Hanuman's the great devotee. He said, because what a service I do. Hanuman, he does a service. I'm just appreciating God. Anybody like to say Hare Krishna? Okay, we will continue our class on Wednesday. Thank you so much. Vanshakopa Tarubyasya Kripa Sindhu Vaidaja Patitana Padara Yoga.